This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9 is celebrating the International Day of Happiness, presented by UEM Sunrise.
It's 7:08 on the evening edition with Kelvin and Hezriel, and as said, this hour we are continuing our focus on happiness. Today is International Day of Happiness, and well, it comes at a tough time. Many social events that bring joy to us in our everyday lives have had to be postponed. Nights out at our local food stall, our mamaks, karaoke sessions, weddings, convocations. I mean, that's just so much.
Yeah, it is. Which has really had me thinking, on a personal note, I found freedom of movement to be something very central to my own happiness. During this whole MCO, I've missed being able to step out for a run or head to my favorite cafe to engross myself in the latest edition of Monocle magazine. Mm. And I've had to come to terms with not doing these things and try to reconfigure how I look at happiness, what it truly means, and whether people can attain it despite the circumstances, right?
Yeah, and looking at happiness in general, it's interesting to see how, well, everyone sort of interprets it differently, and how there have been all these attempts at trying to quantify happiness, as we talked about earlier with the Gross National Happiness Index. And there is actually a lot of scientific research behind happiness as well. And I think you're right. I think at this point in time, with whatever's going on, there is a way to, and there is a need to re-understand and recontextualize what we see as ways to find moments of joy, right? When I think this hopefully finishes, when we come out come to the light at the end of this tunnel that we're in, I think a lot of things that we perhaps may have just taken for granted will be those new moments of joy, right? That we are able to just step out for a meal with our families and our loved ones when we want to, that we can go to a lot of the recent events like any food markets, any festivities out and just be there, right? Right now, we can't do that. And it's actually quite a huge risk to our health and inadvertently our happiness if we do. So right now, I guess just trying to figure it out what you can find to do right now, and you know, extending it to the rest of you. How are you finding moments of happiness at this point in time? You can call us 7733-2900. WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. So we've now got Dr. Melissa Weinberg on the line talking to us about happiness in conjunction with International Day of Happiness. She is a senior research fellow at the Institute of Social Neuroscience and an honorary fellow at Deakin University. Dr. Melissa, welcome to the show. First and foremost, can you help us define what is happiness? Is it distinguishable from, say, joy, contentment, or well-being?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I typically talk about there being two types of happiness. So the first type of happiness is an emotional response, right? So something good happens and we feel happy as a result. And that's what most people think of when they think about what makes them happy. They think of something that they're going to have a happy response to. The thing with that sort of happiness is that it is short term because it's a response to a stimulus. So say, for example, you enjoy coffee, you have a nice cup of coffee and you feel happy as a result. That fades obviously over time, and once you stop drinking the coffee, it might last for a little bit, depending on how much you like coffee. But the other type of happiness that we talk about is a more longer-term, stable, underlying feeling. That's what researchers talk about. When we're talking about, we use the term subjective well-being, and that sort of is the term used to describe that sort of underlying stable sense of happiness that sort of sits back. It's the default that you go back to after you've had a different sort of emotion. So we all feel all sorts of different emotions, but when we're not really aware of what we're feeling at the moment, or there's no response to anything present, our underlying default is our subjective well-being or our set level of happiness. And what we know is that when we talk about it at population levels, for most people, it's about 80%. So we usually sit at about 80% of happiness.
I guess we're all sort of finding that proverbial key to happiness. Based on research, there are specific factors that influence the level of happiness in an individual. What are they?
Yeah, so the way that we measure happiness and the way that one of the most common measures used internationally is called the Personal Wellbeing Index. And even though there are different things that make everybody happy, this index uses or has identified seven key areas of life that universally will contribute to people's general life satisfaction. So the things that contribute to us feeling satisfied with our lives, and this involves being satisfied with seven different areas of our life, and they are our standard of living, our health, what we're achieving in life, our personal relationships, how safe we feel, a sense of belonging to our community or feeling part of your community, and your future security. So there's no recipe for happiness, but if there was, it would have something to do with those seven areas of life.
Right. And with that being said, do different cultures impact the research that you do on the measure of happiness?
So we do have data to support cultural differences, particularly between Western countries. And it's really got to do with the way that people respond to questions about their life satisfaction. So this is called what we refer to in the research as a cultural response bias. So we know that in some countries, looking at non-Western countries, they will tend to respond lower when we ask people how satisfied they are with their life. If we're talking on a percent in terms of percentage points, they'll respond about 10 percentage points lower, just because there's a cultural tendency to avoid the extremes of a scale. So they're less likely to respond on either end of a scale and might hedge towards the middle a little bit. So that's not because they're necessarily less satisfied with their life, but more because there's a cultural response bias that makes them tend towards responding in the middle of the scale. So we know that exists in some non-Western countries, but generally what we find is that and the subjective well-being, as we know it globally, is measured across all sorts of different cultural groups, and the same sort of findings stay relevant. One other domain that that is interesting from a cultural perspective is that we have an optional eighth domain that we explore, which is about people's satisfaction with their spirituality or religion. And in some cultures, that's more important than others. And so that can be a contributing factor as well.
Just a thought here. Are some people born naturally happier than others? Is happiness a nature versus nurture thing as well?
So that's a really interesting question, and there's some more contemporary research on this idea. What we know about subjective well-being is that it has a set point. And when I was talking before about the 80% of happiness, that's the idea that we are set at about 80% happiness, most people anyway. Your set point, like I said before, is a point that which people go back to, but the set point can vary. So some people might be born with a slightly lower or slightly higher set point. It's partly genetic and partly determined by things that happen to them in their early life or any trauma that they've experienced, particularly in childhood. So there are some people, for example, whose set point might be 75%, whereas there might be other people whose set point is closer to 85%. So there's a little bit of a variation in terms of where people's set points are, which means that some people might be operating at a higher level of happiness generally than others.
So how are the findings from happiness-related research applied in real-life scenarios? Can you give us an example of it?
Okay, so I can give you a few examples. One example that sort of springs to mind is when we look at, because we have measured subjective well-being in Australia, we've measured it for the last 20 years through a project called the Australian Unity Wellbeing Index. And so basically what we know is we know what the happiness of the general population should look like. And that allows us to explore different subgroups of the population to have a look at whether they are functioning as well as the normal population. So for example, we've identified in Australia at least that people who are informal carers for other people have particularly low subjective well-being. So once we've identified that, so these are people who are not forced, but they are in a position where they have to care for a person. It's typically usually their spouse or a family member, a child sometimes, or a parent. They're not paid to do that role. So they have somebody in the household who requires care. And so we found that they are highly vulnerable in terms of their well-being compared to the general population, which means that we can then look at tailoring resources or specific interventions to improve the well-being of people who are in that position. I think it's important because there's a lot of talk around improving the happiness of everybody. And what we know with subjective well-being is that not everybody's happiness can actually be improved. There is a normal level within which your happiness should be. And for some people, there's no actual evidence that you can take a person who's experiencing a normal level of subjective well-being and chronically increase it. What we know is that there are groups of people who, for some reason, or for according to different circumstances, are below the average level of well-being, and with intervention we can increase their happiness. So people like carers that I mentioned, people who are unemployed, also have lower well-being, people with low income, some of these things contribute to lower well-being, and with the right interventions, we can work towards improving their well-being closer towards the norm.
Countries like Bhutan and New Zealand have veered away from using the GDP to measure the development of their country as a whole. Do you think that it's time other countries follow suit?
That's where the project that I've been involved with that I mentioned, the Australian Unity Wellbeing Index, which started almost 20 years ago, that was the whole intention, that traditionally when we're looking at measures of national progress, we're looking at things like GDP. And as you said, there are perhaps better indicators of how people are developing or how we're developing as a nation socially. So you'll find that there are these sorts of studies in a number of different countries. And for example, the United Nations produce a World Happiness Report, the OECD have their Better Life Index. So there are these sorts of measures around. The question is how much, from a policy perspective, how much are they being considered when it comes to looking, you know, in comparison with other indicators. So these indicators are certainly around, and they can inform policy to a degree. And personally, I believe they should be informing policy to a larger degree than they currently do.
Right. And sidetracking from happiness just for a bit, why do you think human beings are more prone to remembering or taking notice of sad and anxiety-inducing news instead of the happy ones?
So part of the reason for that is that our brains are designed to protect us. So we are more alert and we pay more attention to negative news, if we want to go sort of positive or negative, but I would think about it in terms of news that might be threatening to our survival. Our brain's job is to keep us alive. So because of that, obviously, it's going to be hearing negative messages louder because it needs to ensure our survival at all costs.
Before we go, are there specific actions that people can take to increase happiness, especially at a time like this when the world is tackling the coronavirus?
As I mentioned before, one of the important predictors of your overall life satisfaction is how connected you feel with the community. And that's where everybody has a part to play in ensuring everybody else's happiness. One of the other things that we know is that time and time again, and in any sort of research study that you will see that looks at happiness, the happiness of people, one of the most important things is social relationships and connection. It's interesting, given, you know, the sort of times that we're facing now when you know, people are being kept apart from other people and, you know, physically distancing themselves. I think it's important to realise that we can maintain a strong sense of community in this time. There was a study in 2008 that looked at the impacts of the SARS pandemic on subjective well-being in people living in Hong Kong. And what they found was that one of the actual areas of life that was particularly impacted was your satisfaction with your community, but not the way you would expect. Satisfaction with community was actually increased during these times. And I'm not sure how you guys are going over there, but over here in Australia, there's some really nice stories sort of emerging about how community members are helping each other, even from a distance during this time. So I think we all have a part to play, you know, if it's helping a neighbour who might be more vulnerable, or even just I know in my apartment building there's messages in the elevator that, you know, if anybody is vulnerable or has to self-isolate, that other members are available to go to the shops and get things that they need for them. So the whole part of belonging to a community is about having access to resources and support when you need it. And now more than ever, there are people who are in need and who need resources and support. And so the more that everybody who can do to help those people, the more everybody will feel an improved sense of well-being. And it's critical to our resilience, especially in these times.
Melissa, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us. You just heard from Dr. Melissa Weinberg, Senior Fellow at the Institute of Social Neurosciences and Honorary Fellow at Deakin University, speaking to us about the science of happiness. And we were asking, you know, what makes you happy at this point in time, at this very moment? Berlinda on WhatsApp says, I found happiness under this movement control order. Now that the children gets to be at home, I'm seeing them more than before. I found joy in planning the meals and cooking for them. Now that they have to have their meals at home, we can chat more now that they cannot go out as freely as before. That is happiness for me at the moment. You can keep sending those through. What makes you happy? To WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio.
This International Day of Happiness special was brought to you by UEM Sunrise. Find your happy.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.